Hello, everybody. This is Stu Smith with another Tactical Fitness Report. And today we have Dr. Kyle Krupa, who is a doctor of physical therapy. And today we're going to talk about injuries, injury prevention, common injuries that we see throughout the phases of tactical fitness, and how to deal with them, and how to be smart about it, and you know, grow into these professions, especially the tactical profession as we get older. You know, you're going to be older longer than you are younger in a career in the tactical fitness world. So learning how to deal with these injuries, whether they're traumatic injuries or it's just a history of athletics that have started to accumulate, you know, with minor injuries in your 30s, 40s. But that's what we're going to talk about today. So, Kyle, thank you very much for taking your time to join us on the Tactical Fitness Report. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate being here. Like I said, I've been following you for years. So,
oh, cool.
Yeah, this is exciting for me as well.
Well, that's awesome. Yeah, and we have some mutual friends there in South Florida. Kyle is a co-founder of Athletics Rehab, and that's athletics with an X, athleticsrehab.com, right? Is that it? Down in South Florida, Coral Gables, Fort Lauderdale area. Is that right?
Yeah, we have two locations, actually. One is in Coral Gables, right outside of University of Miami. And our second location is up in Davie, which is in Broward County.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. All right. So Athletics Rehab. So that's where we're coming from today. That's his background. And we'll talk a little bit about what he does. So he deals a lot with professional athletes, but he also has some tactical side that he deals with, you know, the tactical population. So let's just start off like this. So in the tactical fitness world, I've kind of created these phases that better explain the journey of the individual. So the recruit is trying to get to the training. They're going to be passing fitness tests and preparing for fitness tests. A lot of times there's some injuries that occur with that phase because they're in transition or they're beginners, you know, that world. Then there's getting through the training, right, which could be very challenging, could be a selection process that they're going to prepare for. That has to occur progressively as well, because the volume that they're getting ready to do is going to be pretty great. So you got to be smart and progress logically with that. And then there's phase three, which is the active duty operator, whether you're military, law enforcement, firefighter, you know, that is a complete different journey itself. You know, you got to do the job. You got to be healthy enough to do the job. You have to work around injuries to still do your job. So let's break that down. Let's start off at phase one with the guy who's the recruit and preparing for fitness tests. One thing I always see, shin splints, right from the start.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right about shin splints. And that's probably one of the ones that's like the most nagging in terms of the longevity of that type of injury. You know, and guys really do feel like it's something that they can train through. And, you know, I'm going to go back to your phases, but guys in phase two know at this point that they could just pop a bunch of ibuprofen or get a cortisone injection and probably train through it. But in phase one, they don't necessarily know that yet. So they're just going through a lot of these initial injuries and starting to accumulate a lot of micro trauma over time. What we've seen with not like I was saying before, not only anecdotally, but, you know, within the literature, semi-analyses that we've been doing, we're seeing the major injuries that are occurring more, I'll say, between that phase one, phase two area is bony stress fractures, IT band friction syndrome being number two, patellar tendonitis, low back pain, and number five is ankle sprains in terms of the most common. And really interesting, these are training injuries, right? So talking about prepping guys for the battlefield, for selection process, for all that stuff, versus the actual battle injuries themselves. Musculoskeletal injuries that are occurred within battle or in the line of duty, I think it accounts for like 6% of total musculoskeletal injuries. So versus everything else is overuse, micro trauma, things like that. And then also overseas, oddly enough, basketball being a huge a huge one for ankle sprains. So the, you know, that's really, in terms of like musculoskeletal injuries, acute trauma, ankle sprains was the majority of it. So it's interesting to see. But in that phase one, I'm going to go back to your, to your original question about how do the injuries vary between each of these phases, right? Mm-hmm. So in phase one, where these guys are, it's an education piece. These guys don't understand. They're just told to run. They're not told how to run. They're not told how to prep their bodies to run. They just run. And when you get into that type of mentality, and I also see a difference between, like, so let's say like my Southcom guys that, you know, are sitting at a desk. They're not necessarily like operators, you know, and they're more on the clerical side of things and admin work. Their body type and sitting consistently throughout the day, the types of injuries that they accumulate are actually relative to them sitting all day and not having their glutes turned on. The type of injuries that these younger guys get when they are stepping into a training program, they not necessarily haven't been sitting, you know, for an 8-hour day or anything like that, but those types of injuries just come from a lack of education. They don't understand that they shouldn't be running with their feet pointed out, or they don't understand that they should be running with the right kind of footwear. They don't understand that they need to be doing foam rolling and things like that, stretching consistently. It's just more about, especially with these guys and their mentalities and ego. And I fall into this bucket as well, but you know, a lot of times we skip through that warm up because we're trying to get to the heavy stuff, right? We're trying to get to the very intense stuff. And that's the stuff that we see on TV, and that's the stuff that we see on social media, but like nobody's filming, okay, well, you know, I trained 5 days this week, but I also got body work done twice this week. They're not filming that piece.
You know, that's a really good point. The injuries that occur in this first phase are typically, you know, kids that are finished with high school or college athletics. So maybe they run a completely different way than they're going to be asked to run now, because they're going to be, you know, depending on what they're taking, they will be running, you know, a mile and a half, maybe 2 miles, depending on the branch of service, 3 miles if you're going Marine Corps. So everybody has a different distance, but it's pretty much the same type of running. It is just, you know, hopefully you can be aerobic in that, but a lot of us aren't, you know, because we're just pushing so hard that you go past that aerobic zone and now you're burning sugar to get through this test. A lot of people fail just for nutrition issues, but the biggest reason that I have seen also is, like you said, the IT band issue, the any type of knee pain, shin splints. What exactly? Because this one is always gets me. I mean, I've Googled shin splints and read about them, but explain exactly what is happening to the shin when you're getting a shin splint. The type of person that gets it, you know, is it someone still growing, you know, soft bones and you know, the stretching out, you know, what typically happens in a shin splint?
There's a ton of theory out there, and unfortunately you don't understand 100% the mechanism of injury that occurs. We do know that it's correlated with overuse, right? We do know that it's correlated with poor dorsiflexion in the ankle, all right? So your ability to bring your foot up toward your face, that poor dorsiflexion there. We do know that it's also accumulated to poor proprioception, and then also ground reaction force. So again, correlation does not equal causation, but I mean, I can pretty much align the dots here. So one thing that I always compare it to is back when I was in high school, we would do indoor track and outdoor track. So the indoor track was, you know, it was basically like a hardwood or tile floor. I mean, it was a very hard ground reaction force. And ground reaction force just means that when I land on the ground, I get an equal and opposite reaction going upward. So if I'm hitting the ground either with my heel or my midfoot, I have to understand that that energy is being dissipated up through my knees, my hips, my low back, and all the way up into my shoulders.
Sure.
So getting back to the indoor versus outdoor track, if we are consistently for weeks and weeks and weeks, maybe months, we're running on this hard surface with a certain type of shoe, and then our volume is slightly increasing at this time, right? And then all of a sudden spring would come around, and we're gone with winter track, we go back into spring now, and we get on a rubber track. And we continue that level of intensity on a different surface now and in a different shoe. And I feel like that's when everybody was getting shin splints. That was like my first taste of that. And that's what I see a lot down here in Miami because we have so many road runners. So these guys, when they go out and they rough, there's not a lot of trails that they're able to hit down here. Mm. So they're doing a lot of this stuff on the road. And that requires a different kind of shoe. And then if you're going to transition to the grass or the gravel or something that's unstable, you can't just continue that same level of intensity. You got to dial it back down, maybe coast a little bit, and then ramp back up again. The transition phase needs to be a little bit more progressive, that transition phase. You can't just go right into it, switching from ground, you know, to rubber, back to grass. It just doesn't work that way. The reason being is because the theory is that the ground reaction force, the higher the ground reaction force is, the more those muscles need to contract around the ankle, the foot, to stabilize the leg.
Okay.
I'm going to switch from a hard surface to now a softer surface. My muscles are still contracting that part, and I'm getting less ground reaction force. Okay. So the muscle starts to develop a tendonitis over that from an overuse, where it should be dialing back. You think that it's dialing back. It's not. It's still working just as hard. So that transition phase should probably be, I mean, on the safe side, I would say 2 weeks, you know, when you're gonna be transitioning surfaces. And then obviously making sure that your footwear is appropriate for your type of heel strike. Or I should say your foot strike.
Right.
Because if you're a heel striker, you're constantly applying the brake. People don't realize that running is nothing more than a series of forward falls.
Okay? Yeah.
So if it's and I'm constantly catching myself, you know, with the next step here, so I don't topple over. If I'm landing on a heel, okay, I'm applying the brake every single time. And if I apply the brake like that, I'm actually transmitting that force up through the knee and through the hips a lot harder than a strike, but and absorbing a lot more force through the quadriceps and glutes, not necessarily on the joints themselves. Okay.
Right.
The problem with switching from a heel strike to a midfoot strike is that typically it's not very sustainable, meaning they will, you know, be able to maintain it for a mile, 2 miles, 3 miles, and then by the third, fourth, fifth, they're starting to revert back to that old way, you know, that old running style again. So it's very hard for people to actually like change their running style.
Oh, it's very hard. Yeah. It's very hard. In fact, I wrote an article a while back ago, and I just interviewed 100 people and just asked them how they ran. Mm-hmm. About 70% of them just said, I don't know, I just run.
Right.
And then, I didn't even bother looking at how they run, but they were a mix of, you know,
and I think it's strikers and heel strikers. You know, I tell these guys, I'm like, listen, find a good running store, a running shoe store, where they can actually analyze your gait, take a look at you, see what your natural gait is when you're not like prepped and primed and all that kind of stuff. You know, and we do all the hip back before we go to run. They get you on a treadmill and they watch you what your natural gait is, walking and running. And then they'll fit you in the right shoe based on that. And that's where, you know, if you're a heel striker, you might need a chunk of your shoe. If you're a midfoot striker, you might need a little bit, but more structural support in the middle. There's a ton of science that goes into the,
sure, all
that. But I mean, running in the right shoe, rucking in the right shoe, you know, those are very important to, number one, avoid shin splints. Number two, to avoid plantar fasciitis. And number three, really patellofemoral pain syndrome. That's another one where these guys are going out and rucking with these heavy boots on because you're going a lot of times uphill, you're going through a lot of, you know, varying terrain and things like that. And that footwear is something that you're not accommodated to running in.
Right. Yeah.
So again, it's about transitioning easy into that new footwear, or into that new terrain.
Right. The way I always coach them is like, you got to have a progression going in, because overuse for somebody is not overuse for another person. Right. And overuse is relative.
Right.
You know, so, you know, if someone's not used to running a 5 mile run,
right,
start off with a 5 mile run. You know, you should start off and progress logically. You know, typical progressions from what I have understood over the years is somewhere between 10 to 15% increase each week. You know, if you're not having those pains,
right?
You still don't want to progress when you're starting to have those aches and pains. And
of course, getting back to the actual foot strike itself, there are ways to modify this where you don't actually have to consciously think about it all the time. So one of the things that we've done, especially with our mutual client, was try to up his running cadence a little bit. So he went from, he was running at 155 beats per minute. We kicked that up to, I think it was like 165, 166, something like that. And when you see that, so we have him run on a metronome. So it's tick, 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 tick. Every time you're hitting a tick, you're tapping down and you automatically transition into this midfoot strike. So if you're running with headphones on and just trying to train that cadence and kind of, you know, develop that muscle memory, a metronome is a great way to do that.
That's a good point. Now, is, I know what you just said, is that the same thing as saying, you know, when you increase your cadence, mm-hmm. are you saying also to shorten your stride?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. All right. Yeah. So if I'm not increasing the speed, like let's say I'm using a treadmill, I put that thing on 8 miles per hour.
Right.
And I'm running naturally. And he's running at 155. I keep the treadmill at 8 miles per hour. Don't Got change it. Whatsoever. Take up the metronome pace. Okay. And then now he's got to turn over his legs quicker.
Yep.
He doesn't have the time to heel strike and then recover. Right. Yeah. It's like constantly trying to keep light taps off the floor.
Yeah. If you're over striding, you are most likely hitting your heel first.
For sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then to get into the second and almost third phase as an operator too, these guys are doing a ton of rucking. It obviously depends on which PFT you're training for or you know, just the style of operator you are. But if you're doing a ton of rucking, like the guys that I'm working with this FBI SWAT team down here, they're rucking with 60-pound packs on. Okay, so if they're rucking 4 or 5 miles with a 60-pound pack on, what do you think that does to your center of mass? It pulls it backward, right? Sure. So now I have to lean forward, and I always show these guys a picture of, it's like 50 cadets all running up a hill and they're super leaned forward with that 60-pound pack on. Okay, well, what needs to hold you up so you don't hit the floor is your low back muscles, right? And glutes. So then those things get super fatigued and taxed out. So, you know, we're talking about lower leg injuries, but when you're rucking, you start getting into rucking, that's where you're really starting to see a lot of low back pain as well.
Oh, absolutely. And once again, there's a progression involved with that. You know, there's also a progression with transitioning into boots. I typically tell people don't even start even wearing a boot until you're 20 miles a week into running. Mm. Right. Yeah. Then once a week, you add a boot in mm-hmm. to one of your runs. Do right. that for a month. Twice a week, add a boot in. Right.
So you
got this progression that, you know, you build up to about 50% of your runs in boots if you're preparing yourself for 100% of runs in your boots, you know, once you join the military or what other tactical profession you're in.
Yeah.
Like I said, it's just one of those basic progressions that a lot of people neglect mm-hmm. and they see those injuries that you've just listed, every one of them.
Right. Well, the other thing too, is that the right program is going to, unless you're a natural aerobic athlete getting into this sport and you've had some type of training prior to actually joining the military or training, things like that, those people actually have like a stronger solid base. They have a stronger education behind what they're doing and things like that. But there's a lot of guys that don't have that are trying to transition into this. So guys that are more like anaerobic athletes that are trying to develop this stuff over time, and they feel like because they're naturally anaerobic, they are not adapting to the training as well as somebody that's training next to them that's more naturally aerobic. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
If they don't see that, then they feel that the programming is inappropriate for them, and then they're constantly switching their programs, which is very, very interesting for me because I see a ton of marathon runners and triathletes as well, and those guys, when they get a program, they stick to it. They do not switch their programming. They're very, very in tune with that. Right. And then when I see a lot of anaerobic athletes that are coming through, I see powerlifters, weightlifters, naturally anaerobic athletes that are trying to get into the tactical training piece. These guys always feel that their programming is poor.
Well, the problem is with that is, you know, comparing your athlete to your tactical athlete is the athlete has to be really good or great at a few of the elements of fitness. Right. Whereas the tactical athlete just has to be good at everything. So whatever you're coming into this world with, whatever weakness you're coming into this world with, let's say if you're a powerlifting football player, you're going to have a hard time running.
Yeah.
You might not have a hard time rucking, but you're going to have a hard time running. And, you know, and vice versa, you know, the aerobic athlete, the endurance athlete's going to have a hard time load bearing, going to have a hard time maybe with, you know, pull-ups, but those guys typically do pretty well once they get on a cycle of training. They are able to take that initial strength training of calisthenics and turn it into a muscle stamina exercise, which is what it is when you're right. doing 20 repetitions of pull-ups versus your first one. Right. And so everybody has a weakness is what I'm saying when they come into this world, and nobody likes working on their weakness.
Right. Exactly. You know? So that's why I tell people, I was calling people out in a room. I said, who here does your own programming? Nobody wants to raise their hand because they don't want to bash them for that. So if you're doing your own programming at this point, you know, you're doing yourself a disservice. And the reason being is because you're going to naturally have an affinity to program towards things that you're good at. Right. And those things that you naturally just don't like, you're not good at, what do you think? You're going to somehow come up with a logical progression for yourself? No, it's not realistic, you know? So as far as the programming goes, I just tell these guys, listen, find the good, reputable guys out there, such as yourself, and then make sure that you're sticking to it. Don't look at your buddy that's naturally aerobic and he's adapting to this training much quicker than you are. There's a lot of different things that go into that. But if you stick to it and you trust the process, then the results will come.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And by the way, you know, Kyle is a CSCS as well. You know, so he also not only can heal you, he can also prepare programming for you as well. So he gets you on both ends that are, you know, obviously added benefit of, you know, injury prevention. So what are some of the things that someone can do in those first few phases when they're having those overuse type of injuries occur, to one, prevent something from happening? Well, I think we've kind of listed a few ways to do that, but you know, when they start to feel those little aches and pains coming, what are some of your suggestions?
Sure.
You know, from a variety of those most common injuries.
Sure. Rule number one is education. Make sure that you understand how you run and what your natural faults are, okay? Because if you're going to just get out there and not have anybody analyze, a professional analyze your gait and understand how you run, then you are not going to be able to compound interest on top of that, okay? So when I say compound interest, I mean ramp up your program, right?
Sure.
So if I'm running on top of an arch that's collapsing inward and internal rotation of my femur, you know, I know that I'm going to get patellofemoral pain syndrome. I know that I'm more likely to get IT band friction syndrome, but a lot of people aren't aware of that getting into it.
True.
So like I said, have a professional analyze your gait first before you take on a ton of this running, because you're just going to think that you're doing fine. And then 5 weeks down the road, you realize you have knee pain.
That's a really good point. I don't mean to interrupt you, because people come to me all the time for swimming instructions, right? It's no difference. You know, I mean, you have to obviously get good technique in the water to swim well, to swim and not, you know, overdo it and, you know, blow out your lungs because you're trying too hard, because you still have other elements of a fitness test you have to take after the swim. So there's some pacing that is involved, and there's some technique involved, and obviously conditioning. Same for running. You know, you got to get the technique down so you can practice those miles without hurting yourself.
Right. Right. Well, and that's another thing too, is like, I listened to another podcast of you talking with Jeff Nichols about split times and how to, you know, understand your splits and divvy that stuff out. If you're able to train in split times versus the whole piece of it, right. Maybe you break up that 4 mile ruck into smaller pieces.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, that's going to allow you to train around an injury. Now, the other thing too is with swimming is a whole other animal in terms of, you know, the types of injuries that occur with that.
Sure.
And also the learning curve, I feel like with swimming is way worse than running. I could be wrong. I don't know what your experience was, but I feel like guys that are learning how to swim, that process takes a lot longer just because, I mean, not too many people grow up around the water swimming all the time.
Yeah, that is true. You know, technique takes some time, and then conditioning takes time, and it's a different conditioning.
Right.
You might come in here in great running shape, but that doesn't really apply in the medium of water. the same way. So.
Exactly. So the other thing too is if you're going to, you were talking about how to mitigate some of these risks, right?
Sure.
Like I said, number one is selecting the right program and the right coach to analyze your gait. You don't need that guy to watch you every single time you run. You probably don't even need to check in with them, you know, after the first couple months. But it is something that you want to have, at least have that initial phase taken care of, so you're getting the right footwear and you understand what your faults are and how to correct them. Okay.
Would you recommend using one of these and just like slow motion video, like somebody would just watch you run right past them?
Yeah, so I have all my athletes tapped into an app called Technique App.
Oh, okay.
It's a free app, and we're able to communicate, but they'll send me videos of them running or them doing a certain lift or drill or whatever. And then I'm able to actually, as the coach, I'm able to listen to that, record over the top of it, and do a voiceover, you know, nice. And draw angles and all that kind of stuff. So that's very, very helpful, and a lot of remote coaches do that.
Yeah, I use Coach's Eye. You ever try that one? Yeah, yep. Coach's Eye.
Is it friendly? You like it?
Yeah, that's pretty good. Okay. Yeah, it's not bad at all. Yeah.
I'm not plugging it or anything. What was I saying about that? These guys. Oh, all right. So mitigating risk. Now that you've had your gait analyzed, you got the right footwear, you're ready, you got the right program, you're ready to go, you start to feel yourself breaking down. You got to realize that you are training. Tactical athletes train like pro athletes. A lot of them train harder than my pro athletes. When you're doing that, my pro athletes are in here 5 days a week getting treatment. They work out, they get treatment, they go home. They work out, they get treatment, they go home. And then we have a recovery day, we have, you know, Pilates days, we have yoga days, things that are used for recovery so that you're able to stretch out all that fascia and have that pliability and things like
awesome.
That.
Awesome, yeah.
So realizing that, like, okay, yes, I'm putting in the work, I'm putting in all the runs, I'm putting in all the strength training and things like that, I'm putting in the swims. Where are you fitting in your body work to get stretched out, massage, help that muscle recover, you know, simple things like that. You know, foam roll yourself. Romwad is a great tool where guys log in like 10 minutes to go and stretch, things like that, because it's all self-guided. So there's a lot of tools out there to be able to use. But the number one thing when people start to feel anything is that they just throw ice on it and load up ibuprofen. And you got to understand that the ibuprofen is masking that pain, number one, and it's distorting the normal inflammatory process that's occurring. So your body is trying to heal itself and recover, and now you're pumping a bunch of anti-inflammatories into your body that are trying to push all that stuff away and actually decrease your recovery time. Yes, it makes you feel better for the time being, but how recovered are you getting into the next day?
Right.
So I'm just like, if you could avoid the ibuprofen, I would. It's one thing if you're in crunch time and you have to do it, but it's a whole other animal if, like, you're allowed to play with that amount of time to kind of tone it back down, focus on body work and strength training, and then get yourself back up again.
Hey, on that note, real quick, one of the smartest things I've ever done was, one, listen to guys like you, but I added in a mobility day on day 3 or day 4, depending on how I feel, of my week. I usually work out 6 days, not all hard, cardio days, lifting days, calisthenics days, but my day 3 or day 4 is a mobility day. And all it is 5 minutes of cardio, non-impact, bike, elliptical, 5 minutes of stretching and foam rolling, repeat that 5 times. So it's a 50-minute cycle.
Right.
And then we swim for 10 minutes, we tread water for 10 minutes, and we do all the dynamic stretches that we can think of in chest deep water for 10 minutes. And my God, I walk out of that pool and out of the gym and no pain. And I'm over 50 now. And when you feel no pain over 50, that is a pure blessing.
Yeah. Well, like we said earlier, it's training smarter, not harder. Right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. But I'm still training hard. Just that day is now the mobility day, and everybody, even my 20-year-olds love it. And
but I will say this though, you will not get guys to buy into that type of a day until they are actually training.
Yes.
Not exercising. I'm saying training. There's a difference between going in and exercising and just breaking a sweat, right? That to me is an active recovery day.
Yeah,
but
sure.
Training, you're trying to stimulate a hormonal response to occur in your body. You're operating at a certain level of intensity where you're getting that, you're ramping up your parasympathetics so that you get a parasympathetic rebound, and allow your body to rest and digest. Yeah. So if you're constantly just like, I don't know, I'd say going like 60%, 70%. Do that like 5 days a week. That's where I see all these CrossFitters break down. I mean, there's no doubt. There's no, all these CrossFitters over here that are, they still have the belly fat. Even though they're doing all the CrossFit workouts one day a week and things like that. It's because they're not working at maximal intensity to stimulate that sympathetic response. They're just doing like functional fitness training, not getting not all of them, but I'm saying.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Non-athlete type people. And they constantly stay in a catabolic state. Their body is in a sympathetic state, a rev relatively high, because they never get that hard spike.
Yeah.
And then they just stay in that sympathetic state, and then they start to store cortisol and get the belly fat. I see it a lot.
Yeah, that is very true. You gotta take that easy day. And where I've seen remarkable results is the day five, day six workout. When you take that day four mobility day, it makes the next 2 days.
Effort, yeah.
Oh, it takes the, like you said, from that, instead of going in at 60%, you're up to 85, 90 again.
Right.
You know, or maybe even can take a test that next day and just crush it. You know, so you're near optimal.
Yeah.
You know, as
far as the recovery day goes, Joel Jameson is his name, came out with a pretty good program. That he calls like high performance recovery training, which is, I believe they go on a bike for about 30 to 45 minutes. They do one compound lift with a concentric phase only. Mm-hmm. Right. And then it's all banded, isolated. They'll do like another like 6 to 7, isolation bodybuilding style workouts only with bands with a concentric focus. The reason your lymphatic system to move and pump blood. Okay, so with the eccentrics, that's where you, and isometrics, that's where you really break down the muscle. That's where you break down the tendon as well. But when you're doing the concentric, that's flushing blood. So if we could increase your heart rate, get the heart rate up for a little bit, do a compound lift to get your central nervous system ready, and then do some lightweight, you know, banded resisted stuff, that's been a great recovery day for us as well.
That's really cool. Now, are you doing speed work with that, or like trying to make it a more power movement? With the exercise, or
it's
is it more, just...
it's speed and reps. It's speed and reps on a high performance record.
Yeah. Okay, gotcha. Mm-hmm. That's really neat.
And you're doing sets of 12 to 15. Yeah.
All right, so
it's a great way to flush.
So let's do this. You got the because here's a really big challenge. So phase one, you're the recruit. Phase two, you're the candidate going through selection. Phase three, you're the active duty operator. However, let's say you're the active duty operator that is now trying to, you know, up his career a notch. So now you might be a police officer that wants to go to SWAT team, or you're an Army guy that wants to go to Army Ranger school. So now there's, you know, some transition involved. You're a phase three operator, but now you're back into the phase one, phase two world again. What are some of your, I guess, common issues that you've seen with that one?
Yeah, so that's where you're really starting to get into a lot of chronic overuse stuff, because these guys have accumulated those injuries already. I don't want to say are stuck in their ways, but I mean, they've had a way of doing things for a long time, and now they're trying to get to that next level, and they have to, you know, revamp what they've been doing. So a lot of these guys, they have to switch that mentality into like, okay, it is okay to have a recovery day. It is okay to go and get some body work done. You know, maybe spend a day in a sauna or to, you know, in a hot tub, spend some time in a hot tub, things like that. So I would say those phase three operator guys that are trying to like get to that next level, they are really, how do I say it? They're trying to do too much too fast. Right, because they have this old training background behind them, and they're like, "I'm ready for this," and they just go right back into it.
Sure, you know? Sure.
So I'll see that, and then you know, these guys already have an elbow pain that they're trying to overcome, and now they're getting back into it too fast, and now they're a borderline surgical candidate by the time they come into physical therapy because they've just been pushing through it. Yeah. So guys in their late 30s, early 40s, things like that, we tend to see, you know, okay, this worked for my elbow, this didn't work for my elbow, this worked for my knee, this didn't work for my knee, and where you get a little bit smarter about all that kind of stuff. I need an extra pull day compared to my guy, you know, that trains next to me that's 25 years old. I need an extra pull day than he does.
Oh, absolutely.
You know? So, yeah. So in terms of like the types of injuries, I wouldn't say that the type of injury changes. It stays consistent throughout all those phases. It's just the amount of damage that you've done up to this point.
You're carrying around some luggage.
Yeah.
You know, whenever you're already that operator, plus your ability to recover is decreased because you're a little bit older, but yeah. I mean, your sleep cycle's probably jacked, especially if you're already in operational phase.
Right.
You know, depending on what you're doing, obviously. I mean, you could be working all night. You could be on shift work. You know, so your ability to recover is diminished because you're older, but it's also diminished because you're not sleeping normally. So,
like we said, the demands of the job don't necessarily accommodate you being able to train the way that you need to train and get the type of sleep that you need, maybe get the type of nutrition that you might need to recover faster. Versus like when you were just getting out of high school trying to get into the military and, you know, you got the whole summer to kind of just play around with these things. And
see, no responsibilities, no family responsibilities.
Right. So the overall demand of the job when you're already an operator, like you said, a lot of sleep deprivation, a lot of weird hours and things like that. Very, very high stress levels that are not occurred in an actual training situation. Right.
Sure.
When you're actually like executing a warrant or a mission or anything like that. So you're stressing your body, and then you go back to the, you know, into a sympathetic phase, and then you go to train, you know, 6 hours later, and you're back up into the sympathetic phase again, right? So you're constantly putting your body in this catabolic state and not allowing it to rest and heal. And you know, like you said, get a bigger power output the next time.
Sure. My number one advice for those guys is you have to actively pursue recovery every day.
Yeah.
Whether it's just many sessions of recovery, because that's all you got time for. You know, it's 15 minutes of stretching. It's 10 minutes of breathing and trying to just relax and mindfulness or whatever that is, you know, just kind of bring yourself down, because it's really a tough balance, because that seesaw, like you said, is just kind of going, you know, you're working, you're not sleeping enough, you know,
right.
You're just going to be a little bit out of balance unless you can you know, somehow work it with nutrition and sleep, because that's number one and number two of your recovery.
I don't know if you've used these devices in the past, but like Whoop, are you familiar with that?
Yeah, I like the Whoop band. Yeah.
Yeah. So we tested that probably about 5 years ago, and I liked it a lot. I could say even for me personally, I really liked it a lot. It helped me understand my sleep cycles. But the problem is that it actually operates like a battery for yourself. So if you think of it like a battery on your phone, and I don't know, let's say your level of recovery that day, you wake up and you know, for me personally, on Monday I was at 100%, and then on Tuesday I was at 90, and then on Wednesday I'd be at 70, and by Friday I'm at like 15%. But these Whoop watches, what they were doing, basically I'd wake up in the morning and I'd say, well, I'm at 15%, and automatically I have a bad attitude getting into my workout or into my day. You see what I'm saying? So it gave you an excuse to dog it that day, or to not work out. So what I would say is those devices are good, maybe to gain a baseline for yourself and understand, okay, when I feel this fatigue, this is, you know, the type of output that I'm actually getting. And you could read that on the device, you know, you can see it. It's more visual. But if you're not getting, if you're getting that constant feedback, you start to look at it like a crutch almost, and it could inhibit you, especially as an operator. When you're constantly in high stress situations, sleep deprivation, constant programming, trying to get to the next level for a selection process or something like that, these guys are probably running at 15, 25% all the time.
Right. Yes. So, like you said, they are useful. I did one for about 6 months, and I felt the same way. Like I almost had too much information. But at the same time, what I'd used it for was I used it to say, okay, this is my typical calorie burn when I do this type of workout. This is my typical calorie burn when I do this type of workout. This is my recovery time required from doing this type of workout versus this type of workout. And I really found, you know, it was pretty accurate for that type of recovery, especially when I was doing like heavy lift cycles. I really needed to focus on my recovery more than a cardio cycle. Right, I was doing more cardio on it because.
The other thing too is I had a running joke with my business partner. Like when we first started our business, I had narrowed it down to if I, cut off 2 hours of sleep per day and I only get 6 hours of sleep, that's adding an extra 14 hours per week of my productivity time, and exponentially, times that by 52 weeks. I mean, you're getting a ton of extra productivity time. With that, your body is not okay. Maybe some people could exist at 5.5, 6 hours of sleep. For me, I was just slowly breaking down with that. And then I started wearing the Whoop and realizing what was happening here, not getting the right sleep. The other piece of that is being on electronics throughout the night. So if you're looking at like, okay, well, how can I take advantage of my sleep? Okay. The time that I am going to allot, and I want to maximize the restful deep sleep that I can. There's a couple different parameters that you need to follow. And number one is understand what temperature you like to fall asleep at to help you get into a deeper sleep. So for men, I think it's generally around like 64 degrees is the optimal.
That's cold.
And my wife would kick me out.
My wife would kill me if I did 64.
So that's a constant battle because women sleep a little bit hotter than men do. Yeah. So for guys, you got to be around 64. I think for females, might be in the high 60s, low 70s. Don't quote me on that one. But in terms of getting deeper restful sleep, sleeping at the right temperature, I use blue light glasses when I'm on electronic devices, including my phone, for about 2 hours before you fall asleep. So when you start to use blue light glasses and block those rays out, it allows your body to actually secrete melatonin.
That is helpful. Absolutely.
So getting back to home for 6 hours, I would be sleeping. I had a routine where I'd go to bed at 11, set the alarm for 5, and I would be up before my alarm went off. Like I was up at like 4:58 every day, ready to go. Then once I started using the blue light glasses, I'm sleeping through my alarm.
Oh.
Why would that be? Because your I was in a constant sympathetic state. Right. Where I was hyper aware, I was hyper alert. I was never letting my body come back down into this rest and digest. And then you're constantly trying to get back into the next day. So now you throw the blue light glasses on for 2 hours, and it's like, okay, now I'm getting some deep, deep, deep restful sleep here. So that was a game changer for me, and it's been a game changer for a lot of my athletes.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, and they're real easy to find. You can get them on Amazon for $20. Yeah.
I think I paid $12 on Amazon.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Great, great suggestion. Because sleep's our number one recovery tool. You know, like it or not, you got to get your sleep. And when you're missing out on sleep, you might have the perfect workout dialed in, perfect nutrition plan, but you're going to start exhibiting all those signs of overtraining just by missing all, significant amount of sleep. And it takes some time to do that, but not too much. You know, 5-6 days in a row of bad night's sleep, you'll feel it.
For sure. Yeah. Especially as these guys are operators, they might be out on a mission for days at a time. Obviously your body has to be able to acclimate to that type of a situation. But you almost have to train for it, right?
Yep.
What I will say is when you get that opportunity to have restful sleep, take full advantage of that time.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Don't top off that night off or that day off the next day with a big binge drinking event. Cause that's just going to ruin your night's sleep. I mean, you actually get no sleep when you do that. So let that be a lesson to you young guys as well.
Yeah, that's also true.
So let's do this. Let's talk about the most common injury that you see a little bit, that keeps your business operating, some ways to help prevent that. Yeah. And I know it's very complex to say you're preventing injury.
Yeah.
But,
one thing I learned from you is that I think you're the guy that hates blanket statements, right? There's no one size fits all at all.
Yeah.
Your favorite answer is it depends.
Yes.
So I kind of fall into that same bucket. I really do. It's interesting to see what's in the literature out there in terms of, okay, if this guy has a vertebral fracture known as a spondylolisthesis, then this guy cannot do XYZ, right? And then this guy who has a disc herniation, he cannot do this, and this person can't do that. That has become, maybe in an older population, that might fall into uniformity, but with this younger population, especially with multidirectional athletes versus a more linear athlete, like a tactical athlete, I see a wide array of injuries, and then I see a wide array of how they respond. So it's interesting in terms, like I always tell people as well, you got to realize there's a difference between sports physical therapy and rehabilitation. So okay. Sports physical therapy means that I'm going to keep you active. I'm going to keep you training
in the game.
And we're going to mitigate the risk factors as we're going along. Okay. The problem is that you come in for treatment, you might take two steps forward, and then you go out and train and you take a step backward. And then it's two steps forward, one step back. And when you're in a crunch time, you have to do that. But when you're in a rehab phase, we take out all the aggravating factors. Okay. We find other ways to increase your cardiac output, which there's, I think, of 20 different ways to increase your cardiac output. But we take out actual biomechanical aggravating factors. And then focus just on the injury, and then we get over that. Recovery time is much, much, much quicker.
Right. So when you're trying to stay in the game, you're working out, doing your stuff, doing your practices, then getting treatment. And that's every day.
Every day.
Every day. You got to follow that with every day. So that's to stay in the game. Now, when you are not in the game and you're actually rehabbing, what is the difference? Is it just getting more rest?
The difference is eliminating aggravating factors, right? So if I know that every time I run, I hit 3 miles, I'm starting to experience knee pain, then okay, well, I got to dial that back, right? Or I can't do it at all. Maybe I just take it all the way out. And I got guys that they're doing a ruck upstairs, basically, and they're feeling knee pain almost immediately. Okay, well, you know, if we have time, we can dial that back. We're not going to do any stairs right now. We're just going to focus on that. Now, if the guy was training through that, he's going to have that injury indefinitely, right? I might make him feel better getting into the next workout, but the injury is still there. It's not healing versus that rehab process. You're actually spending more time focusing on healing and things like that. So you're putting your body in a better homeostasis to allow that process to occur. So I'm sorry, your original question though was,
it was just about prevention injury, like the most common injury that you see. Yeah. I guess instead of most common injury, most common activity that causes a myriad of injuries.
Yeah. So I would say low back pain is the number one thing I see.
Okay.
And this goes for any tactical athlete, and this goes across the gamut. These guys have been thrown into training a little abruptly, and biomechanically, when they lift something from the floor, or when they squat, when they deadlift, things like that, or just the over accumulation of ruck time and that forward lean that we were talking about earlier, low back pain really becomes the common occurrence here. Number two would be the IT band friction syndrome and the patellofemoral pain syndrome, which go hand in hand.
And running would be the activity that is
exactly. So, and they go hand in hand. They don't always occur mutually exclusive. Sometimes you get both, but the treatment for both of them is almost the same in terms of we need to get more femoral external rotation, landing more on the midfoot, things like that, decreasing what's called the Q angle. So are you familiar with the Q angle? So if for anybody who doesn't know, the Q angle is if your knock knee, right, and you're getting that knee that kind of caves inward when you're doing single leg stance or squatting, things like that, we want to keep that knee either straight or slightly out. All right. Yeah. That's what helps decrease our Q angle and our risk for injury there.
So kind of like the same thing as knee caving. Is that what we're talking about? Your knee caves in.
Exactly. People who are knock knee, or they look knock knee when they squat, or when they run, their knee almost comes across the midline.
That's a lot of femoral I see that sometimes with women when they run.
Yeah. So and women have a higher Q angle because, their hips are wider, right?
Yeah,
so,
sure.
Childbearing. So they are more susceptible to those types of knee and hip injuries due to the increase in Q angle that a male would have.
Gotcha.
With that being said, some of the things to mitigate some of these risk factors, right? If I'm trying to keep my foot, my knee into external rotation, my femur into external rotation, and my foot straight, okay? A lot of people treat knee pain by just doing a lot of leg extension work. Okay, that is occurring in the sagittal plane. Right? That is not a way to treat a knee, especially when they're bumping inward. If it's adducting and internally rotating, then what we need to do is focus on external rotation and abduction. All right, so I just reverse the action. So we could do isolated exercises that just focus specifically on that. So like I'm a huge proponent of monster walking, wipers, banded sidestepping, side planks, single leg bridging. Those are all things that work on your glute med muscle and a lot of the other internal rotators of your femur, right, to try to keep everything externally rotated and really control internal rotation. So it's not so much that we want to focus on trying to forcefully externally rotate. We want to control the eccentric back into internal rotation. So if we have control of that, then we can control when we run.
Nice.
If that makes sense. So everything that we do, and the main thing too is you got to realize you're adding a lot of steps altogether. So if you're just doing these exercises like 3 sets of 10, 3 sets of 15, how many steps are you accumulating in a 4 mile ruck?
Yeah.
What is 3 sets of 15 going to do for you? You know,
yeah, good point.
You get into high muscle endurance repetitions and do it repetitively. I tell my guys every 4 hours, you know, the ones that have real problems, every 4 hours they're repeating the same exercise.
Oh, nice. Now, is that something you can do daily, or should you have like a upper body, lower body day, you know, in this type of?
Again, when you're dealing with an injury like that, somebody who is literally overcoming an injury, they need it more frequently than somebody who's just doing a maintenance dose.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so if somebody has a pretty significant amount of knee pain, it's really debilitating for them. They're not able to run to the capacity that they want to. That's somebody who needs to be doing this 2-3 times a day, maybe give them like a 5-6 minute routine that they're able to just, you know, okay, I got this mini band, I keep it in my back pocket, and I do these exercises, and boom, good to go. Versus somebody who's doing this more for like a maintenance dose, and maybe throw that stuff in 2-3 times a week.
Make it part of a cool down phase of your workout type of thing.
There's different ways to program it too. Sure. You could program it in the priming. So my guys who have really been valgus force in the knee during the run, I have them prime their hips before they go run.
Smart. Yeah.
Southern Command guys who are sitting at a desk for 8 hours a day, those glutes are shut off. They're not firing. So how do I expect them to stabilize your knee when you're in single leg stance repetitively when you're going to run now? Right? Same thing when you're laying in bed for 8 hours and you get up for that morning run, your glutes aren't working while you're sleeping. Right? So sure. You got to prime all those things, get them to fire, and then go out and do the run. So that's a priming way to
love achieve. That. Yeah. Great idea.
It's just like muscle activation. So we do like maybe 2 sets of 10, something like that, trying to increase the heart rate as well while we're doing it, versus an actual like rehabilitation dose, which would be heavier weight, more sets, more repetitions.
Nice.
And that's where rehab dose, you could throw that into your leg day, like you were saying, like maybe you have a leg day or a core day or something like that.
Sure.
You could throw those in as accessory movements.
Nice.
So we'll focus on that. And then as far as the low back pain goes, the other thing I was going to say about that was trying to reverse all the actions that you're putting your spine through throughout the day. So if you're constantly in flexion, when you're sitting, you're spending more time in flexion than you are in extension. That is putting pressure on the disc that causes the muscles to reflexively go into spasm, and then that's why you have, you know, spasms in your low back.
Sure.
So the more time you could spend in, and this is like, again, I hate blanket statements, but I'm just going to say for the general pop, you want to do, you know, people aren't experiencing significant back pain, something where you just feel like you can still clear this up on your own. Spending more time in extension type exercises. And then spending more time in transverse plane and frontal plane exercises. So transverse plane meaning rotational type work, and then frontal plane meaning like side to side. So you're looking at more like side planks and things like that, side plank holds, trunk holds, that way. But getting more into that transverse plane helps actually mitigate, it builds balance around your spine. Your spine is a cylinder. So if you're constantly doing things forward and backward in the sagittal plane, I'm not going to put you in the weight room and then keep having you do more forward and backward movements, right? Now I need to build balance around your spine. So that's where I start to throw in all these transverse plane exercises and frontal plane exercises.
Yeah, well, I would say part of my education with folks is teaching them that the core is not just your abs, that is actually a system of muscles that go from hips to shoulders, you know, and everything in between. So that's a really good point. What do you think about sitting down and standing desks? I have an adjustable one that I usually do a couple hours sitting and a couple hours standing, because I have found that if I stand all day, my back hurts, and if I sit all day, my back hurts. So.
You found it. You found the sweet spot. So yeah. I tell people, don't get a standing desk. Get an adjustable desk.
That can okay. go
And then the other thing about the standing desk, because I do love that, obviously, the more time you can spend standing pain-free, the better. But also, I don't want you standing in pain. So you have to have the ability to lower that thing down. I think the Swiss ball is a waste of time.
Okay.
Sitting on a Swiss ball,
yeah,
because your hip flexors are still in a shortened position and your glutes are still shut off.
Ah, good point.
I don't even know what you're trying to achieve, to be honest.
I just want to bounce, I guess.
Yeah, I just want to bounce on. So, or get a couple crunches in throughout the day. I don't know.
Right.
So, the I'm sorry. What was I getting at with the? Oh, the standing desk. Yeah. So with the standing desk, you don't want to skimp on the anti-fatigue mat either. So if you go to your barber, you notice that he's standing on a mat around mm-hmm. the barber chair, right? He's
yep.
doing that on purpose. It's because that thing has a little bit of give for his feet, so it's not so taxing and fatiguing on the muscles.
One of these?
Yeah, there you go.
I have one of these that I use every now and then, but I yeah.
So the anti-fatigue mat is something that you really want to invest in, and then the second piece of that standing desk too is something to have your foot on top of, to put one foot on. So if you notice at a, like you go to a bar, they have that thing where you're sitting at the bar stool where you can kind of rest your foot on there, right? That was an old school way to get people to stand at the bar and buy more drinks. So they would get guys to stand there, they could put their foot up on there, it would relieve their back pain, and they would be able to stand there for longer and order more drinks.
Interesting.
So yeah, it's actually a very interesting way, and a lot of standing desks now have that built into it.
I like that. That's a great idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then just rotate the feet, you know, put the left foot up on there. Then
right. No, that's really smart.
You might, and for you in particular, you might be able to buy yourself an extra half hour, an hour of standing per day by doing that.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. When I'm typing, I have to sit. It's just, it doesn't work for me. But if I'm doing like admin stuff, I can stand up and.
The new ones that have a treadmill underneath it. That's incredible to me. I'm like, about multitasking.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive. I haven't gone up to that level yet.
Yeah, neither have I.
Yeah. So hey man, thank you so much for your time. We've gone an hour. I could probably talk another hour with you,
right?
For sure. About all the injuries and ways to help them. But you know, folks, if you're looking for answers to aches and pains, you need to talk to a doctor of physical therapy. Kyle Krupa here is a doctor of physical therapy. He's also a CSCS. He's down in South Florida, athleticsrehab.com. I'll put all the links to him in the description below. Are you on social media as well?
We're at Athletics Rehab.
Okay. Gotcha.
Also, sorry.
That's all right. We're done. We're done.
So I'll run that again.
It's quite all right.
Yeah. All right. So yeah, social media is at Athletics Rehab. And then my personal is at Kyle F. Krupa.
Okay. Gotcha. I'll put all that in the description below as well. So, hey, once again, Dr. Krupa, thank you for your time.
Appreciate you having me.
I appreciate it.
Honestly, I feel like I can talk to you for a few more hours. So.
Oh, absolutely. Anytime you get an idea, you want to talk to my folks about it, you know, maybe something you've seen, maybe some new science that's out on – you know, therapies or training programming. Love to have you back on.
All right.
Absolutely.
Sounds great. Thanks again, Stu. Appreciate you.
All right. Thank you, sir.
All right. Take care.